listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And thanks so much for hanging out with us over the last couple of days. And to Dr. Mike Newcomb for filling in for me. Dr. Mike is really good. He's really good. Thank you, Mike. Or Dr. Mike. Here's the backstory. Friday night, Louise and I were in bed, and it was about midnight. We just got into bed. And the phone rang, and it was one of our daughters to tell us in a rather choked up voice that her roommate of 3 years, partner of 3 years, fiance had just died 10 minutes earlier. She had been with him as he died. He had had leukemia, had been originally misdiagnosed as mono, and ended up being leukemia, which is a common thing apparently. And thanks to Social Security and the Obamacare high risk pools, she's going to be left with not the huge bill. I mean, this could be a wipe you out thing, you know. And the Obamacare high risk pools had just come into effect about the time he was diagnosed last year. And as soon as he was diagnosed with leukemia, he qualified for Social Security disability because he had lost his job, his prior job. He was a physical therapist, and he'd lost his job because he just had no energy. He couldn't work. And so basically they canned him. And it's an amazing story of how our social safety net worked, even though the patient didn't make it through. And Jeff was a wonderful, wonderful person, and we're all going to miss him. And do miss him. But that's where I was. Yesterday I was flying home, and Monday I was with his family and Louise and our family. And Louise is still out there in Portland. She's going to be there all week. And I'm here. And on Friday I'm going to Los Angeles, by the way. And a special shout-out to our Los Angeles listeners. We are now on the air on KPFK, the legendary Pacifica station, 90.7 FM, blowing a monster signal across the city of Los Angeles. And also to our newest affiliate in Gainesville, Florida, WAJD AM 1390. So welcome to both of you, and thanks for having us with you. And Saturday, this Saturday, I'll be speaking at the Gate 3 conference. The website is gatecommunity.org. And I'm also doing a gig with KPFK in the afternoon on Friday afternoon. And you can get information on that if you're listening on KPFK on their website, or if you're in Los Angeles, on their website. So that's what's going on. So Wayne LaPierre, Crazy Wayne, has gone over the edge again. And it's pretty remarkable. I mean, you know, the hearings this morning. Actually, here's the thing did not get brought out in the talks with the members of Congress. And there's a reason why. One of the things that didn't get brought out is that in the 2012 election cycle, the NRA gave politicians $719,000. In my book, Rebooting the American Dream, there's an entire chapter devoted to make members of Congress wear NASCAR patches. If we're going to stay with this insanity that Scalia and Thomas and Roberts, by and large, have, and to a lesser extent, Alito and Kennedy, have dumped upon us, the Supreme Court has dumped upon us, that our politicians can be wholly bought and paid for by an industry, a trade group, or a billionaire, at least wear the friggin' NASCAR patch. Come on. I mean, you know, members of the Supreme Court, they wear these black robes, right? Well, you could make them any color you want. Members of Congress, wear a robe, and on that robe, you put the patches. And so you got an NRA patch, and you got an ExxonMobil patch, and you got a United Healthcare patch, and come on, where are you getting your money from? Where are the damn patches? At least the NASCAR drivers have the honesty to do it. So one of the things you did not hear is a question Mr. LaPierre, how much money did you give to my colleagues in the last congressional session, or in the last election, rather? I mean, that's just, you know, the last couple of months.
$719,000.
How much money did you spend lobbying? Well, several million dollars, was it? Carl Gibson, over at Reader Supported News, wrote a piece, Money in Politics is Murder. He starts out, the Newtown tragedy could have ended differently if the NRA had butted out of the Connecticut State Legislature last year, 2011, a year before last. Now, this is a very progressive legislature, right? It's by and large Democrats. They repealed the death penalty. They legalized medical marijuana. And they had a bill that looked like it was going to be clear sailing that would have limited magazines to 10 rounds of ammo, 10 bullets at a time. And then you got to change magazines. If you can't take out a deer with 10 rounds, you have no business being in the woods. And if you're doing target practice, I've done a lot of target practice in my life. And 10 rounds is, that's a good set, right? 6, 7, 8, 9. I mean, 6 if you're using a revolver. 6, 7, 8, 9 shots, 10 shots. It's enough time to figure out how the sight is off and if there's wind to correct for the wind and figure out how to get to the target. And then you reload, and it kind of gives your muscles and your brain a chance to reset. I mean, frankly, the idea of doing target practice with a 30-shot clip seems to me stupid. And I speak with considerable experience about this. I've never hunted anything alive. I've never killed anything. But I've shot skeet many times in my life, which are those clay pigeons that they fly up in the air and you go after them with a shotgun. And I have shot on rifle ranges, everything from 22 target pistols to the Dirty Harry's 357 Magnum to Uzis. And it just seems to me crazy. So anyhow, there was this piece of legislation before the Connecticut legislature that said 10 rounds of ammo, that's the limit in Connecticut. If that had passed, keep in mind, this was a year and a half ago. If that had passed, you wouldn't have 20 dead kids in Newtown right now and six or eight dead adults. You would instead probably have half that number or a third of that number, maybe even less than that. But it didn't pass. Why? Because this man who has blood drenched, I mean, his clothing should be drenched in blood. He's got blood dripping from his fingers, from the canines of his teeth, Wayne LaPierre, because his organization, the NRA, went in and organized a massive email campaign nationwide about this Connecticut law that produced 30,000 emails to Connecticut legislators, and they killed the bill. Now, let me just share with you some of the insanity that LaPierre shared this morning. Clip number one, Shano.
Proposing more gun laws while failing to enforce the thousands we already have, it's not a serious solution for reducing crime.
Well, let me just ask you a simple question, Mr. Idiot. Why are we not enforcing the laws that we have on the books? Could it have something to do with the NRA and the Republican Party for either 6 or 8 years blocking there even being a person running the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms? Could it have something to do with the consistent and steady defunding or level funding of that organization as inflation and other demands eat away at them? Could it be that the NRA has actually put laws on the books to prevent federal agencies from sharing information with each other that might help them figure out where the real risks are and who the real crazy people are? And in addition to that, and it's not about crazy people, in fact, in addition to that, Wayne LaPierre wants to know your medical records and wants to lock you up.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
No, I'm not making this up. And I'm not talking about, yes, because you threatened the president. I'm talking about because you went to see the shrink because you were depressed. I'll play that for you when we get back. Indeed, welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. Scalia is just plain old bug out crazy. Walmart is not a person. Money is not speech. It's just that simple. Okay, here's what Mr. LaPierre had to say about mental health privacy records. The blood-drenched head of the NRA wants to know if you are going to see a psychiatrist to get some Prozac because you had a rough time in your life or something, or whatever. You know, I mean, people go see psychiatrists for a lot of reasons. Sometimes they go to see psychiatrists just to improve, you know, already reasonable mental health. You don't have to be crazy or depressed or sad or angry or homicidal to go see a shrink. In fact, a lot of very, very healthy, very wise people go see shrinks and get healthier and wiser. And sometimes not, depending on the shrink. But that's a whole other topic that we can talk about someday. And my book, Walking Your Blues Away, etc. But anyhow, here's Wayne LaPierre, Mr. Drippy Blood, on this. Clip two.
We need to look at the full range of mental health issues, from early detection to treatment to civil commitment laws to privacy laws that needlessly prevent mental health records from being included in the National Instant Check System.
Right. That's just what we all need. You know, I recently got one of those You Too Can Fly with the short line things from the TSA where you got to go in and get your fingerprint and all that kind of, which they already have. I mean, you know, I didn't consider it any big deal. And you sit there through the interrogation and the guy, you know, have you ever been arrested? You know, right. Now, I've never been to a psychiatrist. I've never been institutionalized. I've never, you know, although I've spoken to a lot of conferences full of psychiatrists. I've written 7 books on psychiatry, psychology, and psychotherapy. I've done trainings. I've taught trainings, but I've never formally been a patient of anybody. But if I had, I would have found it pretty damn offensive if one of the questions would have been, have you ever seen a psychologist or a psychiatrist or a psychotherapist? And tell me about it. I mean, because, you know, A, do you think that somebody who went to see a shrink because they have, compulsions to shoot people would say, well, I went to see the shrink because I just have these dreams all the time about killing people? No, I don't think they're going to say that. And if they did say that to their psychiatrist, and their psychiatrist has to put that into the database to get a gun permit, what's next? I mean, what happened to patient-client privilege? What's going to happen if you do that? What Wayne LaPierre is suggesting? I mean, you know, one of the many side effects. And we saw this, by the way, this is called mandatory reporting. We saw this, the same thing with certain types of abuse, particularly child abuse laws. In some states, they have, in fact, I think it's now federal, mandatory reporting of certain types of child abuse. And so the result of that is fewer people seek help. Because they know that if they go in and they talk about what they're doing, they're going to end up, you know, the psychiatrist, as soon as they walk out the door, is going to have to dial 911 or file a report, which is the equivalent. So, A, it's not going to stop people who are homicidal. B, you come up with a list of people who are depressive and potentially suicidal, which is the majority of these cases. The majority of these cases are people committing suicide and taking others with them. And so if you come up with a list of people who are suicidal, and now you've got to publish that list so that people get asked about this when they get driver's license? You kill people with a car. A lot of people do. This is why I say, you know, people who own guns and guns themselves should have liability insurance the same as cars. The reason why we have that liability insurance is because you can kill people with a car. Isn't it bizarre that if those 20 kids in Newtown, Connecticut, at Sandy Hook Elementary School, if those 20 kids had been crossing the street and they'd been hit by a drunk driver going 60 miles an hour in a school zone, they'd be just as dead. But Geico or whatever, you know, Allstate, I mean, I pick your health, your car insurance company, would be paying out anywhere from $250,000 to $2 million to each one of their families, because of the liability insurance that everybody in the state of Connecticut is required to carry on their car. I don't know what the minimum is for the state of Connecticut. Maybe somebody in our chat room can track that down and let me know during the break. But there would be money. So these grieving families could at least pay for their funerals, pay for some therapy to hold their families together, because one of the main consequences of having a child die is within the next 5 years, divorce. And one of the secondary consequences for siblings is suicide at some point in their life. And that can be prevented by good treatment, by good therapy, good post-traumatic stress disorder therapy. Get in there, do some good EMDR with these people, do some good, there's so much that can be, but it costs money. Why is it that if these kids had been killed with a car, their families would all have enough money to cover those costs? And probably some of these families, I mean, you know, you spend a few weeks off work, your kid just died, you're grieving, you're dealing with funerals, you're dealing with everything. You might end up losing your job, you're losing pay. I mean, why is it that if these kids have been killed with a car, there would be money to cover that, but because they were killed with guns, with bullets, there wasn't one damn penny? Why? Because of the NRA. Clip number three.
Law-abiding gun owners will not accept blame for the acts of violent or deranged criminals, nor do we believe that government should dictate what we can lawfully own and use to protect our families.
No, but you should accept the blame for the easy availability of guns, which makes the United States number one in the world in gun-related homicides, and frankly, more importantly, gun-related suicides. When I was 18 years old, my best friend, who was occasionally depressed because he had a gun handy, blew his brains out. That happens way too often in America, twice as often as homicides.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Wayne LaPierre really should crawl back under the rock that he came out of. 27 minutes past the hour. Speaking of the truths of multinational corporations, we'd really rather you to know all about. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Wayne LaPierre, this Mr. Blood, taking the position that if the criminals are for it, the NRA is for it. And in fact, if you can come up with a position that the criminals oppose, that the NRA is for, or that the criminals like and the NRA is opposed to, in other words, any place where the NRAs and criminals are in different spaces, call and let me know, because I have not been able to find any. Criminals want large clips. NRA wants large clips. Criminals want to buy guns without having to, you know, show ID or any kind of register. NRA wants that. Criminals don't, you know, no background check. NRA, no background checks. Criminal, yeah. In fact, occasionally, Wayne LaPierre comes right out and says, basically, hey, criminals do it, so we're in favor of it. Here in clip number four is Wayne LaPierre making that point. Here he is.
And when it comes to background checks, let's be honest. Background checks will never be universal because criminals will never submit to them.
Yeah, criminals aren't going to submit to them, so the NRA is opposed to them. It's really simple. And, you know, there's always going to be people who will speed. Let's do away with speeding laws. And there's always going to be people who are going to, you know, rob, rape, pillage, kill, shoplift. I mean, you know, let's start a list of all the things. There's always going to be somebody doing that. Let's just do away with the law. Tell me this man is not insane. The only reason that this guy sat in front of Congress and was, you know, nearly licked up one side and down the other by Republican lawmakers and treated with some deference, at least, by Democratic lawmakers, is because his organization, through his hands, gives millions of dollars in blood money to politicians every election cycle. It's real simple. And at some point, I think, you know, politicians need to start saying, I'm not going to take your damn blood money anymore. Archie in Yucca Valley, California. Hey, Archie, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Sorry about the loss in your family.
Thank you.
You know, the other side of the coin, well, you truly define the word shameful. That's all I was going to use. I don't even want to say his name. They should be the NRA should be embarrassed. Anyhow,
well, I think 10 years ago, the NRA would have been embarrassed. I mean, I used to be an NRA member, and I went through one of their gun safety courses. I, you know, when I was in the Boy Scouts, you know, 30 or 40 of many, many long years ago, the NRA and the Boy Scouts used to hang out together, and they stuff, you know, I mean, not so much, but, you know, there was some association. The NRA was this respectable, membership-driven organization, but in the last 10 years, and there's been some really good reporting on this, in the last 10 years, they have become basically the fronts, the shills for the big gun manufacturers, who, by the way, are the military-industrial complex. They're, you know, there's these big armaments manufacturers, and then they have the appearance of this membership organization, and they've got, you know, a couple of million people that they can freak out with emails and things. But basically, it's a lobbying group now. It's a trade association.
You're right. That's why I say the membership should be hurt by this. Anyhow, what I called to talk about is, you know, I'm retired now, but when I was young, I had ample opportunity to, I was a collector of many guns. And one thing I would do when I would see the gun, look it over, I would call the police department, give them the ID, of, you know, the serial number, and they would tell me if it was stolen.
Right.
Now, just a little further extension would be a simple, if I remember right, it's been so long to buy a gun at a gun shop or a gun show, we fill out a paper. Now, why not send it to the a copy to the seller and the buyer, or they can go into their local police department. You know, the thing is, the handguns are way out of control. And one, see, I had a friend murdered, but you mentioned, I couldn't believe it, you mentioned target shooting. Mm-hmm. Have you ever done visual scenario situation target shooting?
I don't know what that phrase means.
Okay, I used to work on...
Yeah, are you talking about where the figures pop up and stuff like that?
Not pop up. No, this is all on...
My shooting has always been either on in my brother's range. He lives rurally, and he's got basically a berm of dirt, you know, and we just
put
targets there. And then there's a shooting range in Mason, Michigan that we go to. It's just, you know, it's a standard kind of police issue shooting range where you clip the target on and you spin the thing out to 70 feet if you want and just fire at it. And you know, you can take your pick of targets. I always use bullseyes, but there are people who are shooting at pictures of people and things. I don't like doing that.
Well, I had the opportunity to, because I was building these indoor ranges for the military,
mm-hmm.
and they use lasers, and they use compressed air because they go right up to the M60 machine gun.
Hmm.
And I got to fire the different weapons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody gets hurt, but they do it with visual projected scenarios in the house, out in different environments.
Right.
Then they do speed competition because it's all on how you react.
Right.
And
whether you react smart or stupid.
Absolutely. And you can, if anybody's listening, military men will know what I'm talking about. The chaos when they first, because we were building a new range, and one of the DIs came over and invited us to come in. Well, for a couple hours, it was mind blowing.
Yeah, yeah. When I went through the Georgia Police Academy, they had something like that. I did not participate in it. I didn't do, you know, the whole weapons training thing with them at that time. But I know that they have a very sophisticated shooting range. And you know, long before you ever discharge a weapon, you learn everything about it.
Oh, absolutely. And one last thing. For home protection, the best thing is a short-barreled shotgun. The first round should be a very fine snake birdshot.
Yep. Then you can do like Dick Cheney did, take down a guy without killing him.
Absolutely. And
I mean, that guy hit the ground fast, I guarantee you.
If you want to use a handgun for home protection, the revolver is the most reliable, and the first round in it should be snake shot. They make them in all calibers,
yep.
because you don't have time to aim, and if you don't have proper training, you do not react naturally to the idea of pointing.
That's right, and you want that spray shot. And you want a non-lethal spray shot, by the way, because who knows who else is standing in the vicinity.
Love your brother. You got it.
Yeah. Okay. We've both been there. So, Archie, it's great to talk to a guy who knows what he's talking about. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Noah in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Noah, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you. I just want to send you my condolences for your
for almost son-in-law. Thank you.
Yeah. You're welcome. I just thought it was interesting that whether you're on the side of pro-gun control or you're on Wayne LaPierre's side, I heard this from Gabby Gifford's husband. They seem to want to blanket blame so-called mentally ill people for all of these tragedies.
Right.
My first point is, if you're mentally ill or so-called mentally ill, you're more likely to be a victim of violence or abuse than to commit it.
Yep. Well, let me take it a step beyond that, if I may. Shano pointed this out to me during the break. He has some of the greatest insights. He said, "Do you realize that if Wayne LaPierre's, check to see if anybody's ever been a psychiatrist before they get a gun thing goes through, that probably all of the families of the 20 children who were killed in Newtown have gone to see a therapist. If they haven't, they certainly should, which means that they may not be able to buy guns in the future."
Right.
I mean, how bizarre is that?
I'm a consumer of mental health services. Mm-hmm. I've never owned a gun, never desired to own a gun. I don't live in the gun culture. I'm not advocating that mentally ill people should get guns. I'm just saying, as somebody who's so-called mentally ill, I have no desire to get a gun, so it's not even an issue with me.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you a story. The Nazis tried to kill off or sterilize 70 to 100% of the schizophrenics leading up to World War II and during.
So, yeah, it was part of their eugenics program.
By the 1970s, they had the same number, if not more, schizophrenics in their population than any other industrialized country. So maybe it's a systemic failure, a systemic byproduct of industrialized countries, societies, that they produce mentally ill people. So maybe we should look at what actually causes.
Yeah, we should. And Noah, did you see the piece in the New York Times last week by the schizophrenic college professor about how he learned to live with his schizophrenia?
No, but I'm familiar with John Nash, who also doesn't
use
medication.
Well, he references John Nash, but this is an absolutely brilliant piece. And one of my nephews suffers from schizophrenia, and so I spent a fair amount of time looking into it. You know, there's some really interesting correlation causation kind of studies that suggest that women who experience the flu or other high fever diseases during either the first or second trimester, I forget which it is, are more likely to produce children who in their late teens and early 20s will exhibit schizophrenic behaviors. But who knows? Who knows? And it may well be adaptive. I mean, it might even be something that's useful. But the shaman in many societies are the schizophrenics, and they're honored. So, Noah, thank you so much for the call. Great to hear from you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I'm not saying we should arm our shaman, but I think that we should respect our shaman. And Wayne LaPierre, he's no shaman. He's a show. It's the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. And Rick in Alberta, Canada. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Let's see.
Boy, you sound Canadian. I love it.
Well, thank you. if an assault weapons ban would work, fine. But I'm wondering whether even calling it a ban, is working against that. What we have here is, of course, we have our background check, which gets you an acquisition certificate.
Mm-hmm.
That's good for non-restricted, which is shotgun, rifle, things like that.
Right.
Now, if you want a handgun or something towards the assault weapon type, you have to have a reason for it, and then that falls under restricted.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that they're banned outright. You just have to have a reason and go through a stricter check.
Right. Yeah, so which is not unreasonable.
Better.
Yeah, what I have been arguing that we should be doing here in the United States is the three simple things that we started doing with cars in the 1920s and 1930s when we realized that cars were starting to go fast enough to kill people, including their drivers. And that is, number one, you register it. It's registered from the time it's created until the time it's destroyed. You know where that is, and if it's stolen, you know which one it is. So you register it. You register the weapon. Number two, you demonstrate that the owner, the user, has proficiency, that people who are shooting or people who own weapons that can be fired, both, have to have a shooter's license, the equivalent of a driver's license. And if you're going to loan your gun to somebody, they damn well better have a license. Just like if I'm going to loan my car to you and you don't have a license, I'm in big trouble. And number three, there should be liability insurance. Just simple, inexpensive, cheap. $25 a year is probably what it would end up being because, you know, there's a lot of guns and very few gun murders, relatively speaking. You're far more likely to be killed in a car. So it would not be very expensive. But there should be liability insurance so that if that gun is used or you use it inappropriately, then somebody gets compensated. I continue to think it is insane that those 20 kids in Newtown, their families are getting squat, bupkis, nothing, when if they had been killed by a crazed driver, they'd all be getting million-dollar payouts from the liability insurance that are required in every state in the country for, you know, to own a car. This just seems... Yeah, and then on top of that, you can say, okay, your driver's license... You know, we have three different kinds of driver's license that I know of here in the United States. You have, and there's probably others, but we have a basic generic driver's license, drive your car. Then there's motorcycle licenses that a lot of states have. And then there's what are called commercial licenses that are like for 16-wheelers, for big rigs. And maybe there's a truck license in some states for, you know, some sort of intermediate. But you have a license that's appropriate to the weapon that you're going to use or the vehicle you're going to use. That should be the same case. Yep. And that's what you guys do in Canada.
That's right. And you also, the safety part of it, you have the right to drive a car, or I mean, you have the permission to drive a car, but you don't have the permission to drive a car with no brakes on it.
Right.
That'll be taken off the road.
Right.
So same thing for storage of a weapon.
Yes.
Or the handling, the transport and things. Like
yeah.
You say, big rigs, they have a stricter safety inspection.
Yep.
You know, because there's more consequence to it.
Yep.
And same thing with the weapons.
Yep. Show me you know how to use it. Show me that you've got a trigger lock. Show me that you've got a place to keep it where the kids aren't going to get it. Show me where you keep your ammunition so that the kids can't get that. Not necessarily show me, but demonstrate it
right.
Have liability insurance in case you're lying.
Yeah. Yeah, and the other thing is carry permits. You can get them here, but you have to have a reason. And, of course, you know, stricter regulations. And interesting, one reason that you'd have up here other than security work or something is if you're out in the bush for bears.
Yeah,
things like that. But
although you know what's more effective with bears than a gun is spray pepper, because spray pepper will make them run 100% of the time, whereas a gun will sometimes just really anger them.
Well, a gun's a last resort, and you have a different attitude when you when you're carrying one. You know, I have carried shotgun that in some cases, just if I get stuck out alone. But no, you're better to work on your attitude and awareness. So
yeah. You're right. The way you react to the bear is going to determine an awful lot about whether it charges or runs.
Exactly.
You're absolutely right. And that's something that people learn when they live in the woods. Having lived in the woods where we had bears myself, I can tell you about that. And you obviously know it too. Rick, thank you very much for the call. Great to hear from you. I appreciate it. And thanks for listening to us there in Alberta, Canada. Ed in Belfair, Washington. Hey, Ed.
Hey, Tom. Thank you very much for your voice. And thank you for giving we the people a voice. And sorry about your loss.
Thank you. You watched the hearings this morning on TV?
Yes, I did. I'm home sick, so I watched the whole hearing this morning, and you made a comment about Mr. Pierre coming out from underneath a rock. I'm not sure if that's where he came from, if it's not a lot lower than that. But after listening to him testify and the tyrannical government, I guess I haven't heard one senator say anything about maybe if they're that paranoid about the government, the military, defunding the military, taking 10-20% of that and putting it into the states and boosting the police force where they're doing so much austerity. I think this morning one of the senators, wasn't Hatch, but it was a Republican, McCain's buddy, made a comment to the police officer that he asked him point blank if he's hired any new police officers. And they really haven't. And where I live, they haven't in the last 3 years.
Right.
Anybody that retires... They haven't been putting any more people on.
Yeah, and if you look at New York's example, community policing, What they did is they looked for what are called hotspots. They did this computerized thing, and they found those areas where there's a lot of crime, and they just started having police randomly show up, you know, for just 10, 15 minutes at a time, randomly, 2-3 times during the day, and crime went down. More cops on the streets. It's really simple. Clinton put 100,000 extra cops on the street. George W. Bush came in and said, we can't afford that, took those cops off the street, and gave the money to defense contractors to fight a war in Iraq instead. Basically put those cops back on the streets of Baghdad, which was nuts. And I am totally with you. And you know, the founders are with you, too. The only thing that the government can fund that has any restrictions on it, the government can fund Social Security forever. It can fund, you know, pretty much anything, you know, air traffic control systems forever. It can fund anything it wants forever with one single exception. And you can read this in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, the Army. The Army has to be revisited every 2 years. Every 2 years, the budget for the Army goes to zero. Because the founders wanted there to be state militias. We call them National Guards now. They wanted there to be state militias responsible to the governor of the state who then, in case of a national emergency, could respond to the president of the United States. But, you know, two layers of civilian control. They wanted there to be a militia, not an army, not a standing army. And that's why the Second Amendment starts the way it does, you know, in order to maintain the security of a free state. Well-regulated militias necessary. I realize I'm mangled. We can't. Ed, thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour, and the government's next target, taking your IRAs, 401ks, and private pensions. I find this fascinating. Lowell Ponte, PhD, futurist with Swiss American Trading Company and co-author with Craig Smith of The Great Debasement. Their website, inflationdeception.com, if you want to check it out. Lowell, welcome to the program.
Tom, great to be back with you.
Thank you for rejoining us. In your article, you write, first, it opens, is President Obama prepared to use executive authority to confiscate your private firearms in violation of the Second Amendment? To the best of my knowledge, the answer to that is no, he has never said any such thing. But let's leave that as an open question, because I realize that, you know, Wayne LaPierre and some others are quite paranoid that he might do this. So then you go on to say, does anyone doubt that he's also ready to use executive authority to confiscate your life savings? And you say progressives apparently see such confiscation, that would be of the 18 and change trillion that people have in their IRAs and 401ks. Progressives apparently see such confiscation of savings as a way to enrich government, stimulate the economy, and redistribute wealth. Progressives think it's unfair and unequal that self-reliant, responsible citizens defer their pleasure to create savings accounts with their hard-earned, hard-saved money. Am I quoting you correctly?
You are quoting me correctly.
What progressive are you quoting?
I'm not quoting a progressive. I'm talking about the knowledge I've had of dealing with progressives for 60 years.
Can you name one, please? I would like to talk to somebody who thinks like this, because this is insane. This seems to me like the worst kind of straw man, unless you yourself are hallucinating.
Why, we had Franklin Roosevelt confiscate people's gold in 1933.
He reimbursed them for new taxes. Excuse me.
He didn't. Yes, he did. He gave them $20 for gold that only weeks later, when put on the free market, was worth more than $30. In other words, he grossly underpaid them for their gold.
Okay, arguably, but, you know, and I'm not a big fan of that. I don't think that was the smartest thing that he did.
In 2010...
But I don't know of any progressives today who are saying, let's take the 401ks of working people and do... What is it you think progressives are going to do with those 401ks?
In 2010, the Obama Treasury Department and the Obama Labor Department were both discussing replacing people's 401ks with annuities. They were investigating this. It was reported in Investor's Business Daily. It was discussed at length by among others, Newt Gingrich.
Well, before that, Ronald Reagan replaced IRAs with 401ks. If you're talking about doing it the way that Reagan did, it's like, okay, here's another option. I would love to have an option. I don't have a 401k because it's a scam. It's you know, the average person who has a 401k in their 30s, who opens one in their 30s, by the time they hit 65 and retire, they've spent over $150,000 in fees to banksters. It's got nothing to do with government. 401ks are big money for the banks. That's why the banks lobbied for them during the Reagan administration, and that's why we got those instead of IRAs that were much more self-directed and much more self-contained. And there's all these rules associated with it.
And Reverend Jesse Jackson, by the way, as a presidential candidate, also called for taking pension funds and requiring the pension funds to invest a large portion of their money in things like low-income housing for the poor. In other words, to divert that wealth to progressive spending costs.
Well, low-income housing for the poor, oddly enough, is a very good investment. There's a lot of people who get really rich running, you know, being slumlords.
Well, there certainly have been in Detroit, where you could buy a house for $1,000, turn around, have the government rent it, the house to the poor, insure it for you, and they'd pay you $700-$800 a month forever.
So Jesse Jackson is a smart investor. I don't understand why you're attacking him.
Because he is telling pension funds they have to invest their money.
No, he never said that.
In progressive. Yes, he did.
You
could go back and look that up. That's not really disputable.
Suggesting that pension funds should be investing in socially responsible things
to invest in those things. It wasn't an option. It was a requirement that Jesse Jackson won.
Okay, so you've got one guy that you can pick on right now, Jesse Jackson. So we'll stipulate I still don't see that Jesse Jackson has said that it's unfair and unequal that self-reliant, responsible citizens defer their pleasure to create savings accounts with their hard-earned, hard-saved money.
We should not be telling people where they must invest.
But you already are. Ronald Reagan created these 401ks. That's why, like I said, I paid my taxes on my money. I put my savings wherever I want, damn it. And I'm not going to have some guy at Goldman Sachs do it for me.
And was he requiring that investment be made in conservative groups and causes? No.
Well, Jesse Jackson wasn't requiring that either.
Well, that's generally what is meant by low-income housing. By the way, this is not just an airy-fairy theoretical issue. Don't forget, in 2008, this is exactly what Argentina did. It simply swept away people's pension funds and replaced them with government bonds that were worth about 27 cents of their face value.
It's because their entire economy collapsed. It's because the banks robbed them blind. It's because they had been run by a military dictatorship.
I have no doubt that this would only be done if some kind of pretext like that could be found or created. But then that's why so many in the Obama administration have made "an emergency is a terrible thing to waste" their slogan.
Rahm Emanuel's phrase. Don't you think that it's far more likely that if somebody is going to steal the 401ks of Americans, that it's going to be the people who actually have possession of the 401ks of Americans? It's going to be the banksters on Wall Street? Don't you think that they're already stealing our 401ks?
Well, they are. They're doing it in slow motion, as I said.
Churn rates, fees.
And inflation. Inflation is a form of theft, after all. It devalues the money you're trying to save. And right now, the government is practicing what economists formally call financial repression. That is, they're holding the interest rate banks pay you below the rate of inflation, meaning every day you have your money in a bank account, you're actually losing purchasing power.
Yeah, the actual inflation rate for the last quarter annualized was 0.6%, which is pretty damn low.
The real inflation rate was closer to 7%. The government holds an artificial inflation rate and announces one, because if they didn't, they would then have to pay cost of living increases. Something, by the way, that Mr. Obama did not do in 2009, 2010, 2011. The
people wasn't his choice. These were rules that were put into place by Ronald Reagan again. All the rules on the cost of living adjustments on Social Security were put together by the Moynihan Greenspan Commission. Put together by Ronald Reagan, signed into law by Ronald Reagan, saluted, you know, all the Republicans saluted that flag. Let's have one generation pay for double pay, not just the retirement of their parents, but retirement of themselves.
Well, and all of that is contingent on the numbers for inflation that government comes up with. So it came up with a number for inflation that didn't count gasoline, didn't count the cost of food at the supermarket. And voila, suddenly there's no inflation, because they omit all kinds of things from their inflation index.
So are you suggesting, I just want to understand this, you're suggesting that the people that we really have to be afraid of are not the banks on Wall Street. They're not the transnational corporations that want to put out of business, the Walmarts that want to shut down all the local businesses in your neighborhood. It's somehow the people that we elect to public office.
What we have to be afraid of is bigness. I happen to be a libertarian. I like small business. I like decentralized power. I like power in the hands of the people.
So then you want the government to enforce the Sherman Antitrust Act.
I want there to be no giant crony corporations like General Electric.
So you want the big government to enforce the Sherman Antitrust Act like they did through the Carter administration. Carter broke up AT&T.
Well, because monopolies of that size only exist when government backs them. If government simply stopped backing them, you would see decentralization.
Not at all. Have you ever played the game of Monopoly?
I have.
It's got nothing to do with the government. It's, you know, the big companies buying up other big companies, and eventually all you're left with is a giant fish. But anyway, we'll have to live to fight this one another day. Lowell Ponte, futurist with Swiss American Trading Company, co-author with Craig Smith of The Great Debasement. InflationDeception.com is the website. Lowell, thanks for dropping by. Good talking. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, if the government is going to take your 401k, I wish I'd had the time to ask, what's the solution? Okay, it hit me. Our guest, Lowell Ponte, is a libertarian, and he's not here to defend himself or speak on his behalf, so I'm not going to attack him, and I'm not going to try and speak on his behalf, but I do know libertarian philosophy quite well, and so if a libertarian were to say the government is going to come and get your guns, the solution is, you know, do away with the government. Excuse me. If a libertarian were to say the government is going to come and take away your IRA and your 401k and your private pension. And by the way, I personally do think pension, although I don't have one, but I think that pensions are better than 401ks. I mean, at least, you know, defined benefit plans as opposed to defined investment plans. At least you know what you're going to get. But in any case, if the government's going to come and get it, then do away with the government. I mean, that's what a libertarian would say. So if you're going to have a 401k, well, first of all, if it's a 401k, that means it is defined and regulated by the government because 401k is part of the tax code. I mean, if you don't want the government involved in your savings, do what I did, which is fiscally stupid. I mean, you know, looking back now over the last 30 or 40 years, I probably should have opened an IRA when I was young, and I should have been adding to it all these years instead of paying taxes on the money and then investing it and whatnot. Not that I've got a pile of money anyway, because typically what Louise and I have done is every couple of years we'll sell a business and then we just take a year off. And, you know, it was a great life. We've had our vacation, instead of taking our retirement at the end of our lives, we've taken our retirement 6 times now in all the years we've been married, the 40 years we've been married. So, but in any case, you know, I probably should have done 401ks or IRAs or something, but whatever, if you know, internal individual retirement account, the original IRAs, the 401ks, these were invented at the urging of banksters. The banksters lobbied for these variations in the IRS code so that people could set aside money pre-tax. And then when they retire and their income is much lower, they would pay and they take the money out, they would pay the tax rate that would be, you know, when they retire. And there'd be all these fees and penalties and fines, and the companies could churn the, you know, if you gave them permission, they could churn the stuff, invest it for you. and you know, the average person in the course of their life spends $150,000 in fees on their 401ks that they give to the banksters. So anyhow, if you're really afraid that the government is going to come and take it, well, the libertarian solution is do away with the government. No more rules, no 401k, no IRA, no nothing, just you and the bank. Doesn't that sound great? Just you, me, and Wells Fargo. You, me, and Bank of America. You, me, and UBS. You can trust the banksters. They would never sell you a bleepy deal. Paraphrase Carl Levin. They would never take advantage of you. I mean, IRAs, are you kidding? Of course not. Oh, my. Peter in Voorheesville, New York. Hey, Peter, what's up?
Well, Tom, I'm really encouraged. Monday, on January 28th, I opened up my local paper, the Times Union, and there was a letter on real fear was slave rebellion. And it was an excellent letter. It was by Edward Fagan in Albany, one of your listeners. And he said a well-regulated militia was necessary for the security of a free state. And he went into the reason on why free state and not nation and not the United States. And also, further down, he says the purpose of the Second Amendment was to preserve slavery. Try learning that from Wayne LaPierre.
Yeah.
And also he said, for those who wish to pursue the topic further, we'll find an excellent historical discussion by Tom Hartman for Truth Out at HTTP.
Right.
At and I thought it was a really interesting letter to help educate the public, and also a comment on the federal spending down 15%.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in the Navy in the 70s, I was a Navy pilot, and we had an expression back then, the beatings will continue until morale improves. Well, right. I think of that as the economy. The cutbacks will continue until the economy improves.
Yeah, yeah. I don't disagree with you. And Dean Baker actually has a really interesting piece out right now suggesting that this economic slowdown, this cut in our GDP, is actually the consequence of dialing back on the war in Iraq. We've cut our defense spending. And Obamacare has reduced the rate of inflation, the growth, the expenses associated with medical expenses. And so these are actually good things. And that other areas of the economy that reflect actually, he says government spending fell at a 6.6% annual rate, driven by a 22.2% decline in defense spending. And so those are actually good numbers. Now, I think that we should be making up that decline in defense spending by building roads and bridges. But and Peter, thanks for the heads up on my article being quoted in your local paper. That's really cool. Thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Mike in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You like 401ks.
Hello?
Hey, you're on the air.
Yeah, my name's Mike. Yeah, well, first I have a comment. My crazy right-wing brother keeps telling me that the government's going to come and take my IRA and 401k away from him. Now I know where he's got that information.
Yeah.
Such silliness. No, you know, you kind of disparage 401ks, but I was able to retire early at 55, and that big part of it was because I put money in my 401k.
Yeah.
I'd worked for TRW Aerospace Company. You know, and you put 6% and they matched 3% of it. And,
yeah.
You know, and I guarantee you I had very little expense. I was able to trade within it. And, you know, it's one of the things that allowed me to retire.
Well, you were a smart guy and a smart investor. I never was that. And I will, you know, that's why I don't give investment advice on this show. Cause
yeah.
And also, I never worked for a big company that would match my investments. I always worked for myself.
Well, that's true. But, you know, most of 401ks go to big companies. And another thing that you can do when you retire from a company at 55 or above, you can start withdrawing from the 401k at 55 versus 59 and a half without having to pay a penalty.
That's nice. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. I think deep down inside, before I was 30, I was convinced I wouldn't live past 30. And I think deep down inside, I was convinced I'd never live till 65 anyway, so.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's the legacy of being, you know, an old hippie and in the SDS and all, and never trust anybody over 30. And you just don't think you're going to end up being an old fart someday. This is incredible. The 10 most regressive state tax systems. Think Progress has this up on, you know, thinkprogress.org on their website. The poorest 20% in Washington state pay an average of 16.9% of their income in taxes. That includes the sales taxes and everything else. The top 1% in the state of Washington, keep in mind, the poorest 20% pay almost 17%. The top 1% pay 2.8%. In Florida, the poorest 20% pay 13.2% of their income in taxes. The top 1% pay 2.3%. This is really quite remarkable. In Texas, the poorest 20% pay 12.6% of their income in taxes. The top 1%, 3.2%. That's really amazing. That's really... Oh, and by the way, this is hysterical. There's this PSA, Sheriff David Clark, for Milwaukee County, and this is like as in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And the Journal Sentinel had an article about this, which I'm going to share with you in just a moment. But this is Sheriff David Clark doing a PSA for the county, basically saying, hey, we're living in the age of Republican austerity. It's a libertarian world out there, so you're on your own, Charlie. Here he is.
I'm Sheriff David Clark, and I want to talk to you about something personal, your safety. It's no longer a spectator sport. I need you in the game. But are you ready? With officers laid off and furloughed, simply calling 911 and waiting is no longer your best option. You can beg for mercy from a violent criminal, hide under the bed, or you can fight back. But are you prepared? Consider taking a certified safety course in handling a firearm so you can defend yourself until we get there. You have a duty to protect yourself and your family. We're partners now. Can I count on you?
This safety message brought to you by the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office.
There you go, the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office. Get a gun! So, Makisha Cooper got a gun. And fired it. And she said, I know my rights regarding having a firearm because I heard Sheriff Clark on the radio stating that I could own a gun to protect myself. She had a .40 caliber Smith & Wesson semi-automatic handgun. That's a nice weapon. That's a powerful weapon. She got a fight with her niece. She went to her car to get the gun. She fired it once in front of the house. Not at anybody. She just fired it like, hey. She faces 18 months in jail and $20,000 in fines on two misdemeanor counts. The headline in the Milwaukee Journal newspaper, woman's excuse for firing gun, Sheriff Clark said it was okay. Steve Schultz of the Journal Sentinel writes, a 36-year-old Milwaukee woman had a ready excuse when Milwaukee police approached her Sunday about firing her gun on the 2300 block of West Burley Street. Makisha Cooper told police that Sheriff David A. Clark Jr. had said it was okay for her to arm herself. I know my rights because Sheriff Clark on the radio told me to get a gun. I mean, this is the Republican answer. Right, this is the Republican answer to, oh, we got a lot of crime. We got too much crime in the streets. Well, let's cut back on our police and tell everybody to get a gun. There's actually video of that as well. It's not just audio. But here it is again. Just listen to this is an actual real PSA that the county sheriff's department put out, and this woman took it seriously. Here it is.
I'm Sheriff David Clark, and I want to talk to you about something personal, your safety. It's no longer a spectator sport. I need you in the game. But are you ready? With officers laid off and furloughed, simply calling 911 and waiting is no longer your best option. You can beg for mercy from a violent criminal, hide under the bed, or you can fight back. But are you prepared? Consider taking a certified safety course in handling a firearm so you can defend yourself until we get there. You have a duty to protect yourself and your family. We're partners now. Can I count on you?
This safety message brought to you by the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office.
You have a duty to get a gun. Oh, what have we come to? I mean, this really is the libertarian answer to everything. They say, oh, well, you know, they want big government. Big government, yeah. Police departments, fire departments. I think that's a good thing, frankly. A real interesting study that I read last week on how New York City is one of the most crime-free big cities in the country and arguably in the world. Why? Because Mayor Bloomberg, to his credit, a guy with whom I frequently disagree, he's been a Republican, a Democrat, now he's an independent. Actually, it was in different order. He started out as a Democrat, then he became a Republican, and now he's an independent. But in any case, Mayor Bloomberg put more cops on the streets and sent them into areas where there were violent crimes rather than just, you know, basically ignoring them. So, anyway, Joel in American Fork, Utah. Hey, Joel, what's on your mind?
Hey, how you doing today, Tom?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up, Joel?
Okay, yeah, I've been hearing a lot of talk on Congress, and there was a big article in the Salt Lake Tribune about it today about cutting back on federal spending will reduce the number of cops, teachers, and firefighters. I'm just curious, then, why the hell am I paying my taxes to the city of Snyderville and the state of Utah, then, whenever it's the Utah Fire Department or the American Fork Fire Department that would put out my house fire, or anytime I get pulled over, it's a Utah state trooper and not, you know, a federal district, whatever state,
right.
You know, federal.
Yeah, the answer is pretty straightforward. Back during the Clinton administration, and it really started during the Eisenhower administration in a small way, but it got much larger during the Clinton administration. They provide supplemental federal funds that, you know, depending on the state, depending on the community, depending on the crime rate, depending on a whole bunch of variables, there's a formula. But basically, the federal government is giving your state and your local community money that supplements. You are paying taxes, and you are paying the major share of your fire department, your police department, probably somewhere between 75% and 95%. But like I said, depending on where you live, if you live in a really poor one of the ideas was that really poor communities have no tax base, yet they've got a big crime problem. So what are you going to do? Just tell them sorry, good luck, get shot? No.
Where the state comes in.
Pardon?
That's where, you know, your state as a whole would come in.
Yeah, but what do you do if your state is Mississippi or West Virginia and it's got no money?
There's better places of it, but yeah, as a general rule, they are the poorer states. So
yeah.
There's places there that are better. So,
you know, if you're poor, you don't have the option of saying, well, gee, I think I'll rent a $5,000 a month apartment in San Francisco. No, I mean, you know, you're living in Mississippi in the house that your great grandfather left you that's got a, you know, a market value of $11,000, and you know, the state's got no very little revenue coming in. There's not much of an economy there, and the economy that is there is based in large part on oil, and all that money's being skimmed off by a few rich folks. So there's some federal funds available. So anyhow, in answer to your question, Joel, that's what the situation is. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am fine. What's on? What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to talk about two things. First of all, I want to ask you a question about the wording of the Second Amendment in a minute, but
mm-hmm.
I'm actually trying to get something going here with starting a bill to require liability insurance on guns here in Washington State.
Mm-hmm.
And my proposal is this, that with permit to carry, we're both open carry and concealed carry, or essentially any time you're going to take your gun out of your home, hunting, open carry, concealed carry, even if you're going to bring it to the gun range, you have to have some type of liability insurance. My proposal would say that if you don't intend to take your gun out of your house, you don't have liability insurance, but you may be liable for and with your gun if it gets out of your home for some reason, stolen, used in a crime, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So that would either give you incentive to buy liability insurance anyway, even though you don't necessarily, or keep your dang gun locked up so that nobody can get it.
Yeah, I would submit to you, having been a 10-year-old whose dad occasionally had a copy of Playboy magazine around and he thought it was, you know, well concealed, I would submit to you that there's no such thing as a gun that a kid can't get into, A, and B, that the probability of a gun in a home,
mm-hmm.
being used to commit suicide or accidentally shoot somebody in that home is statistically higher than the probability of that gun being used to stop a burglary in the home. In other words, it happens more often. So I love your logic, but I would say that the gun in the home is probably more dangerous than the gun when it leaves the home.
Well, that's probably true, and I know.
So let's have liability insurance cover all of it.
Well, that's a good. That's why
your liability insurance on your car covers it while it's sitting in your garage. You know.
Sure. Well, that's why I'm discussing trying to get feedback from people.
Okay, we have about a half a minute before the machine is going to drop some music on us. You had a question about the wording of the Second Amendment.
Yeah, it says a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state, and it says the right of the people.
Right.
And I've noticed
plural.
That the people is a used as almost as a proper noun, always associated with the state. We the people of the United States. So the people does not mean the person. And so what I'm submitting is that the Heller ruling, Heller versus D.C., was actually unconstitutional because the federal government has to allow the states to have a...
militias. Yeah, National Guards. I agree with you, and I think Heller was wrongly decided, but I think that a lot of what Scalia did was wrongly decided. Paul, thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's just so common sense. Treat guns like cars. Registered, insured, operator's permit. Real simple. Minutes before the hour, defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman with you, and Paul in South Lyon, Michigan. Hey, Paul, you have some thoughts on the NRA and criminals?
Yeah, how you doing, Tom? Yeah, that was a great point you made about the NRA always agreeing with the criminals on the same side of every gun issue. And I think the reason is that criminals are the best customers of the gun industry, and the NRA are nothing but a bunch of gun pushers for the gun industry. And, you know, the only difference between gun pushers and drug pushers is gun pushers kill a lot more people than drug pushers do.
That's an interesting hypothesis. And I'm not sure about the numbers, but that's a very, very interesting hypothesis. Paul, thanks for calling and sharing your perspective with us. Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, is on the line. And, Bob, well, what's going on in the world today?
Oh, Tom. Well, the gun issue is, you know, the front and center issue in Washington. There are a lot of things going on, but the obvious emotional testimony of Gabrielle Giffords, former member, and then Wayne LaPierre. And Gabrielle and her husband have, you know, started a group that's for reasonable type of gun legislation.
Mm-hmm.
Wayne LaPierre did not alter from the position, you know, that I would have assumed he would take, although I would say the debate will start now, Tom, and some of his membership may alter from that position, however.
Well, you already have.
Yes.
The vast majority of his membership, I mean, only 8% of Americans agree that there should be no background checks. I mean, that's lower than the rating of Congress. I mean, that's...
Oh, wow, that's low.
That's actually, in fact, I got a list here. Where'd it go? It's going to take me a second. Oh, here it is. More Americans agree with polygamy, human cloning, and love their member of Congress than agree that there should be no universal background checks.
Correct. And but people today had said, well, you know, they thought he would change his position. He's not going to.
No, he's not going to. He's paid $1 million a year to hold that position.
He's not going to do that. That doesn't mean they won't do winks and nods to members as this issue progresses. And when I say the winks and nods, the private nod that they're not going to spend a ton of money against a certain member if they vote, in fact, for a piece of legislation.
But they're still going to score votes, aren't they?
They'll score them, but they won't. There's a difference. I hate to say this, but there's a difference in D.C. between scoring the vote and putting the money behind that score.
Right. No, I understand. And you know, you were here and you were there. I mean, you know, you were in Congress. You know how it works. So I believe you.
Correct. And then immigration, of course, the bill was unveiled in the Senate. It was sort of who went first, but the bill was unveiled in the Senate. I thought something interesting. Senator David Vitter, Republican from Louisiana, called Florida Senator Marco Rubio, a Cuban-American Republican, amazingly naive and nuts on the issue of immigration, which I thought was way out of character where Senator Vitter should have been, because Rubio is going to be the man on the Republican side that starts to tackle this issue. The other interesting thing was the statement by Karl Rove about how Governor Jindal, you know, would be on track with the new face. And I kind of thought, chuckled to myself, well, maybe Karl Rove needs to remove his face from the debate.
Well, Fox has removed him.
New face.
You know, I'm curious. David Vitter, for our listeners who don't, that doesn't ring a bell, but it sounds familiar. David Vitter is the guy who got busted with the D.C. madam and came back to Congress and back to the Senate and was given a standing ovation by his Republican peers. Apparently they like the D.C. madam. And ran for re-election and was re-elected. He represents Louisiana. He's one of the two senators from Louisiana. Correct me if I'm wrong, Bob.
That's right.
And he's increasingly become kind of a Tea Party-ish Republican. Marco Rubio is one of the Republican senators from Florida and a fairly young guy, the son of Cuban immigrants and right-wing Cuban immigrants, anti-Castro Cuban immigrants. And he is one of the leading lights to be, he and Jeb Bush are fighting it out for who's going to be the guy who's going to run for president on the Republican side in 2016 on the platform of Latinos Love Us. And so was this David Vitter shouting out to his Tea Party base who by and large hate immigrants? Or was there some kind of personal animus, or was there a policy disagreement? I mean, does Vitter want to run for president? I mean, what's the backstory here?
No, it's Tea Party. It's Tea Party. It's not that he's so stern philosophically on something of this nature. It's the Tea Party issue. You know, he did get in trouble, as you pointed out, and fact remains, you know, he needs to, you know, because of some past situations, continue to strengthen his base. Mm. I think that's what he did on the back of Senator Rubio, who I don't know why anybody would criticize Senator Rubio for trying to do something on immigration. I don't understand it.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I would think that the Republican Party, including the Tea Party guys, at least they would just keep their mouths shut because, you know, they took a drubbing. I mean, over 70% of the Latino vote, and these are not immigrants. These are the people who are just of that ancestry. But our U.S. citizens voted for the president, voted Democratic in the last election. And if Republicans don't get with the plan, which is what Rubio is trying to do and what Jeb Bush is trying to do and a number of other Republicans, John McCain is trying to do, he's now come out against it. You know, he was against it. He was for it. Then he was against it. Now he's for it again. And you know, they're all saying, you know, if we don't change our position, we're going to get beat in the midterms and we're going to get beat in the presidential election.
And Rubio has the credentials to do it, being Cuban American,
right?
And more believable than John McCain ever would be.
Right. So is David Vitter going to suffer as a consequence of this, or
no.
has he strengthened himself with his base, and it'll just roll off Rubio because people for whom the immigration issue is an issue just consider Vitter a crackpot?
Yes, he strengthened his base, and the other people are not giving tongue lashings to Rubio as he did. So I think, you know, he just wanted to achieve that little day in the sun with maybe the Tea Party.
Yeah.
And the other news today, the Obama administration released new regulations, and that will implement the individual mandate on the signature part of the president's health care law. And, of course, that would those are the rules that will say about, you know, buying, purchasing the insurance, or potentially paying a fine. So they're starting that process. The other
wait a minute. The administration is putting into place the rules?
They're beginning that process.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, that's a good one. You had a really quick one?
Oh, I was just going to say about the appointment by the governor of Massachusetts and Scott Brown, implications of the Massachusetts race by Chief
of
Staff.
Yes. Do you think that's because Deval Patrick himself intends to run for that seat?
It must be, because I just couldn't.
That's the only thing that makes sense. Yeah, that's the only thing that makes sense. Bob Ney, Talk Radio News. Go for the oldgoats.com. Thank you, Bob.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We've been talking over the last couple of weeks about how in the ratifying convention in Virginia in 1789, that to ratify the Constitution of the United States, that there were objections made by Patrick Henry and George Mason in particular, that Article 1, Section 8 gave the federal government the power to control to what extent the state militias were armed. And their concern was that Virginia's state militia was one of the principal tools used that it had a component which was the slave patrols, one of the tools that was used to put down slave rebellions. And I wanted to get somebody on who really knows this stuff, somebody who's an expert on this, not necessarily on the Second Amendment or the Constitution or any of that kind of stuff, but on the whole history of the slave resistance and rebellion. And Junius P. Rodriguez is with us, a professor of history at Eureka College in Eureka, Illinois, the general editor of several reference books on the history of slavery in the U.S. and the world, including the Encyclopedia of Slave Resistance and Rebellion. The website where Dr. Rodriguez is a professor is eureka.edu. And, Professor, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
I'm curious. 1607 was when Jamestown, you know, the first settlement by Europeans, white Europeans, on the North American continent. And within 15 years, they had the first slaves in that settlement. And then, of course...
Well, the first Africans were introduced in 1619, and they likely were introduced as indentured servants. It's very difficult to pinpoint a precise date when slavery would have started in Virginia, but it's likely within the first decade or so after the arrival, where indentured servitude found a way to morph into slavery.
Right.
And instead of someone serving for a period of time, it became a life sentence of sorts.
And, in fact, one that you passed down to your descendants.
Correct.
So here we had this period of slavery in the United States from the early 1500s until arguably, you know, the 1860s, 1870s, and which is, you know, a period of several hundreds of years. And in some parts of the United States, the African-American slaves significantly outnumbered the white populations, and in other places the numbers were very, very large. How did, in the Django movie, the character that Leonardo DiCaprio plays says, why didn't they just rise up and shoot the whites, kill the whites? How was slavery enforced?
How was slavery enforced?
Yeah, how did they maintain this institution?
It was enforced in large measure by means of local control, that individual states had what were called slave patrols. And there was an understanding that all able-bodied men in the community, which, interestingly enough, also included free blacks who would have lived in areas where slavery was practiced, had a responsibility of being part of the patrols. And usually in local ordinances, this was stipulated where there might be a couple of weeks per year where individuals would have the responsibility of being part of the slave patrol. Now, the truth of the matter is, a lot of times these tended to be enforced on an as-needed basis. Mm-hmm. So if there were threats of unrest, if there was the likelihood that violence might arise, what you would see is a greater enforcement of these slave patrols. But the interesting thing is that the patrols were actually something that was separated from the militia.
Mm-hmm.
What we're talking about is groups that oftentimes on a spontaneous way could arise and really sort of serve in a vigilante type capacity if there was a threat of violence arising in a particular area.
So you're suggesting that the slave patrols, if they had a modern antecedent, would be the KKK as opposed to the militia, the modern version being the state national guards?
Well, not exactly. The patrols, what we have to consider is that the patrols fell within the policing power of the states.
Mm-hmm.
And so the states were within their rights in terms of their policing powers to be able to enforce slavery as it existed. And I know this is a challenging thing because we're talking about enforcing something that today, you know, we consider to be an extremely bad policy to be enforcing.
Yeah.
But if we go with the assumption that slavery was legal at the time and states had the responsibility of enforcing it, they used the patrols as the mechanism to do so.
To what extent did slaves rise up in rebellion?
It happened occasionally. It was not as common as some would imagine. There was a book that was written in the early 40s called American Negro Slave Revolts, written by Herbert Aptheker. And it was a controversial book when it came out. He suggested that there might have been as many as 250 uprisings of some sort that occurred from the colonial period through the time of the Civil War. Now, one of the problems with that number is that any time that Aptheker ran across a mention of a threat of a revolt, a fear of a conspiracy, in any of those things, he counted that.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the actual number of true insurrections or revolts in which large numbers of people banded together and used armed resistance, that number is going to be quite small. It's probably going to be less than a dozen incidents that would be true slave insurrections.
So the Stono one, for example.
But that's
during the roughly 80-year period from the founding of the country until the Civil War. But what about the 200 years that preceded that? Is it the same?
Well Stono is 1739, and so it's the main revolt that you would find during the colonial era. There were some smaller threats of revolt that occurred in New York City in 1712 and 1741. But to go back to the earlier point of how we count these and how we number these, one of the points that I often make when I'm speaking to my students about this is we have to keep in mind that there's a difference between resistance and outright rebellion. Both of these are going to be very forceful features. But one of the things when we talk about resistance, we're talking about an act that an individual can perform rather than specifically a group.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about something that often can be powered by what we might call the weapons of the weak. So as an example, if I get into the habit of breaking tools on the plantation or farm where I work, that is a form of resistance. It's a type of passive resistance, perhaps. But it's slowing down the work process. If I'm part of an economic unit on this plantation or farm, and if I'm destroying the equipment that's being used, I'm causing economic harm and distress to the larger plantation economy. Another great example is you would be amazed at how many times arson was used. You hear about sugar houses that are being burned down, cotton gins, tobacco barns, and you know, my assumption is that these things are not just happening in a spontaneous sort of way, but this is really by a larger design.
Mm-hmm.
Things like work slowdowns, foot dragging of sorts, basically taking longer to do a particular kind of task that might be assigned. All of these things are forms of resistance that can be performed indeed by individuals using, as I said earlier, weapons of the weak. Mm-hmm. But in terms of people coming together in the larger numbers, what I've found is individuals were generally willing to turn to that option if they believed that the likelihood for success might be great. So, for example, you mentioned Stono earlier. South Carolina, as early as 1708, had a black majority.
Dr. Rodriguez, we have to take a very, very short break here. Can you hang on? We can pick up on the other side of this break?
Sure.
Okay. We're talking with Dr. Junius P. Rodriguez. He is a professor of history at Eureka College in Eureka, Illinois. That website, of course, eureka.edu, and is the general editor of the Encyclopedia of Slave Resistance and Rebellion. Thank you, Reverend.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So how was slavery enforced before it was entered in the United States? Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Junius P. Rodriguez, a professor of history at Eureka College, the editor of the Encyclopedia of Slave Resistance and Rebellion, eureka.edu. And, of course, the book, you can find it, your favorite source for books. It's published by Greenwood. And, sir, I'm curious your take on the argument that has been made. I don't know if you read it. I made it. Professor Carl Bogus made it. Others have made it. I was more quoting them. That Patrick Henry and George Mason explicitly, and in fact, it's in the record. I mean, you can read their words, that they explicitly said that they wanted the Second Amendment to say free state rather than free country. Free country was the original draft that James Madison had put together, because their state militias were in part of the state security apparatus that maintained the institution of slavery in their state, and they were afraid that if that militia fell under federal control, that northern states, if they had emergencies, they could call the militia away from their state, which would leave them defenseless. Or if the northern states took power over the federal government and were hostile to slavery, they could basically disarm the militia by refusing to apportion funds for arming them. Are you familiar with that argument? And if so, what are your thoughts on it?
I'm familiar with it. I would say this. There was some connection between the role of the militias and maintaining order in slave societies. But keep in mind that the militias were separate from the slave patrols, and much of this responsibility fell on the patrols.
Right.
So it would have been an extraordinary kind of circumstance where the militia would have had to be involved in this. Now, keep in mind also that when we're talking about the colonial period, there were a lot of dangerous potential situations that could arise, slave resistance being one of those. There were a lot of indigenous tribal peoples who might be potentially threatening some of the settlements, in particular as you got into the mountain regions. On top of that, keep in mind that there really is sort of an economic and class divide that we find in colonial America and even into the early republic, where, let's say, something like Bacon's Rebellion or Shays' Rebellion comes along. What you're going to have is individuals who seem to be out of the loop of sorts in terms of the social order and the economic order challenging the power of the day. And so what you see happening oftentimes is the militia sometimes is going to be used against fellow citizens who seem to be the poorer sort. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting with Bacon's Rebellion, for example, you actually do have some slaves and some indentured servants who do join that particular campaign against the power of the royal power of the Virginia colony at the time.
Mm-hmm. And yet, Patrick Henry, in the ratifying convention, his objection, he said, and I quote, "In this state, there are 236,000 blacks, and there are many in several other states, but there are few or none in the northern states. May Congress not say that every black man must fight? Did we not see a little act of this in the last war? We were not so hard pushed as to make emancipation general, but acts of assembly passed that every slave would go into the army should be free." He was objecting to Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. He said, "If the country be invaded, a state may go to war, but cannot suppress slave insurrections under this new Constitution. If there should happen an insurrection of slaves, the country cannot be said to be invaded. They cannot, therefore, suppress it without the interposition of Congress. Congress and Congress only, under this proposed Constitution, can call forth the militia." What does that mean to you?
One of the things that does come to mind is an effort to make sure that there would be a rather strong Southern interest in the powers of the new government, the powers of the Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some who, in the early federal period, do start talking about a slave power conspiracy, the idea that somehow powers that were created in the Constitution specifically granted more power, in effect, to some of the Southern states. And then if you look at who was elected president in the early years, you know, many Southerners were elected.
Yeah, a lot of Virginians.
Serving on the Supreme Court, who was serving as Speaker of the House.
Right.
A lot of the powerful cabinet-level positions. But I think we also have to factor in that one of the great debates that existed then, and to a certain degree exists even to this day, is how we look at state powers compared to the power of the national government. And there were a lot of individuals, in particular among the anti-federalist crowd, there were a lot of individuals who were quite leery of centralized power in the national government at the time.
Sure.
And I think it's safe to say that even today we find individuals in various political groups who might share some of those sympathies. But I wonder, and I don't claim a particular expertise on this, but I wonder if the concern about making sure that the word state is specifically used was because they recognized or they felt that the power of the states at the time should truly be supreme to any power, any type of interposition authority that the national government might have.
Mm-hmm.
And so they wanted to make sure that it was explicitly clear that this power was granted to states.
Kind of an extension of the 10th Amendment, or at least
true.
That logic.
Yeah.
And did any of this, and also during the Revolutionary War, I mean, the British had used slaves against the Southern states in as much as they offered freedom to any Southern African American who defected to the British side.
That's true. We first saw that in November of 1775. Lord Dunmore,
yes,
the last royal governor of Virginia, had issued a proclamation in which those individuals who were who were enslaved, if they were willing to leave their plantations and farms and go to the British lines and serve, you know, within British forces.
So between the British, and ultimately they did invade in 1812, between the Canadians, between the British offering freedom to the slaves and the Spanish down in Florida offering freedom to the slaves, the southern states felt somewhat squeezed. Would that be fair to say?
I think it is. And what's interesting is in the case of the British, the promise was indeed kept. As, the so-called black loyalists after the war were able to leave North America, or certainly leave the 13 colonies. Some of them went up to Canadian Maritimes.
Sir, we're out of time. Hang on just a minute.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I'm sorry, it's the tyranny of the clock here. Dr. Junius P. Rodriguez, professor of history at Eureka College. I've loved the conversation, the book, Encyclopedia of Slave Resistance and Rebellion. Thank you, sir.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
It's the good, the bad, and the very, very potatoriously ugly, the good. Patrice Motsepe. Motsepe, a South African mining billionaire, announced earlier today that he will be giving half his fortune, including future earnings, to charity. Worth around $2.7 billion, Motsepe said he wanted to join the Giving Pledge, which encourages the world's wealthiest to give at least half of their wealth to charity. Speaking about his donation, Motsepe said that the money will be used to help the large portion of poor and other disadvantaged and marginalized South Africans. Over half of South Africans live below the poverty line. We can only hope that America's billionaires decide to stand alongside Mr. Motsepe and donate some of their vast fortunes to help the entire nation, and especially those Americans who struggle to survive every day. The bad. Tennessee State Senator Stacey Campfield. The Republican has proposed a bill in the Tennessee Senate that would tie a family's welfare benefits to their children's academic success. Campfield believes that by threatening to take away a family's welfare benefits, children who perform poorly in school may perform better because their parents will be more motivated to see them succeed. Of course, what Campfield doesn't realize is that children from families who receive welfare benefits who perform poorly in school are doing so most likely because of their family situation. The stress of having to worry about their family surviving day to day affects their academic performance. So in reality, taking away welfare benefits for poor academic performance will only make the problem worse, not better. And very, very ugly, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. The group of Catholic bishops has submitted two briefs to the U.S. Supreme Court in the two marriage equality cases that are currently before the court. In both of the briefs, the group argues that the court should rule in favor of LGBT discrimination because the LGBT community doesn't deserve any legal protections because the legal protection only defines them as the legal protection because any legal protection. Boy, is this bad. Let me try this again. The community doesn't deserve any legal protection because the only thing that defines them is their voluntary actions, in quotes. The brief goes on to state that, quote, indeed, with this distinction in mind, this court has recognized that a finding of a suspect or quasi-suspect classed for equal protection purposes is simply inappropriate when the distinguishing characteristic is a product of voluntary action. It's been proven time after time again that being homosexual is not a choice. A person just doesn't wake up one day and decide to be gay. And yet the Conference of Catholic Bishops argues that the LGBT community should be denied rights because of this faulty logic. And that is very, very ugly. Very confusing, too. I got it. Okay. Rachel in Lisbon, New Hampshire. Hey, Rachel, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. About 2 weeks ago, someone wrote an editorial to our little newspaper up here talking about your slavery and the Second Amendment, and he was very, very good with the facts and everything. But this week, a real conservative person said that that was totally inaccurate and came to he put up a website that said it was. And I don't know if you've heard of this. It's called The Root.
Oh yeah.
And
Yeah.
And they, they're talking about, this is something written by Paul Finkelman, doctor from Albany Law School.
Yeah, he goes to great length to treat me with derision and sarcasm, which is typically what people do when they lack facts.
I was just wondering what you thought of all of this, if you know this guy and why he would say these things and what you think about what he said.
Well, this is the second time that he's gone after me. I wrote a piece some months ago, although this time he went after me by name. I wrote a piece some months ago about how Thomas Jefferson spent much of his life trying to end slavery, and he did. It was the first piece of legislation he introduced when he was in his 20s in the Virginia House of Burgesses. And how opposed he was to the institution, even though he was a slave owner. I mean, there's a certain schizophrenia associated with that. And he wrote a piece for the New York Times called The Monster of Monticello, basically saying, no, Thomas Jefferson was just an evil man. And my words, not his. And then he sought to take apart the piece that I wrote for Truth At. I think that he made a couple of good points, and his main good point was that slave rebellions... one of my arguments was based on what Professor Carl Bogus had said, which was that slave rebellions were, the Stono Rebellion in particular, which was in the 1730s, I believe, was quite famous. The slaves had actually cut off the heads of the white plantation owners and stuck them on stakes, and, you know, they terrified the whites in the South. And that there were probably many, many more rebellions than were reported. And I said that in the article. And the historian that I just spoke with and two other historians I've spoken with have said, no, there probably weren't that many slave rebellions. There were more passive forms of resistance. That doesn't mean that my premise, or for that matter, Dr. Bogus, Professor Bogus's premise, because he's the guy who actually put it first forward, and there's a link to it in my article.
I read that, yeah.
It doesn't mean that we're wrong. It just means that on that one point, I overstated the situation. There were slave rebellions. There were not hundreds of them, apparently. There were dozens of them. And there was, you know, active and passive resistance to slavery. But I thought it was unfortunate that Finkelman chose to go after me in an ad hominem fashion.
Said that you have a total misunderstanding about the nature of ratification of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And I've listened to you long enough to be immensely impressed at your knowledge in all of this, so yeah. I don't know where this is coming from.
Well, I think it was just personal attacks. He clearly didn't bother to click through in the article that I wrote to the actual words of George Mason and Patrick Henry and James Madison, because all of the statements that I made as, you know, broad or general statements actually had specifics to back them up, and there were links in the article to them. And I was disappointed that he hadn't done that, but. You know, in fact, I was tempted to have him on the air, except that the article had been so much of an ad hominem and there were so few facts. He quoted nobody in the article other than himself that I decided not to respond to it. And in fact, this is the first time I've mentioned it. So, but Rachel, thank you for raising the issue. And I think it's a conversation. Yeah, it's a conversation that will continue. And thank you very much. And in fact, you know, the fact of the matter is the title of that article when I wrote it was The Second Amendment Was Ratified to Protect Slavery. And really that was a secondary purpose. The principal purpose of the Second Amendment was to stop standing armies. And I've been talking about this for years, and there's very little dispute about this, that the founders were wary of standing armies. Now, the southern states also were wary of their slave patrols being disarmed. And their slave patrols, there was an overlap, according to some sources. Now, Dr. Rodriguez felt that there wasn't that much of an overlap. I've seen others who suggest that there was a really significant overlap between the slave patrols and the militias. And I would guess that during the Revolutionary War period, there probably was much less of an overlap, and probably for the 100 years that preceded that and that followed that, there was more of an overlap. It's always a challenge to try to take any piece and generalize from it. Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle writes and blogs for Huffington Post and others about the Occupy movement. Mark, you had a quick comment you wanted to make or a report?
Yeah, actually, I have a new piece at Truth Out, Tom, about the lack of freedom of press in the U.S., but I wanted to give you some stories that I've been covering for Free Speech Radio News on Pacifica. So a shout out to all the Pacifica listeners out there and the folks at KBCS. But in Washington State, there's a vote coming up to abolish the death penalty. There's also a real scam that the GOP is trying to promote here to count our electoral votes by congressional district, which is totally insane.
They're promoting that in Washington State too?
Yeah, it's part of a national.
Well, it is a national thing. Yeah, it's being pushed presumably by Alec and the Koch brothers.
Well, there was an alert that went out from the Democratic State Party on that one, and then the ACLU put out an alert on the death penalty vote coming up. But what I wanted to talk to you about was the gun buyback program, because Seattle and King County just started it, and on their first day, Tom, they got 716 weapons collected, including a rocket launcher. And the way that they're doing this is that the Amazon and some other local businesses have gotten involved, along with the Police Federation. They raised over $100,000. They've already given out $80,000 of it, so they need to raise more. But, $100 gift cards from Amazon for anyone who turns in a handgun or a rifle or shotgun, and $200 for assault weapons. So according to Mayor Mike McGinn and the King County Executive Dow Constantine, has been a great success. They have collected 716 two months ago in Los Angeles. They collected 2,000.
Wow.
And this is the second time that Seattle's done it since 1992.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to put that out there, because a lot of folks are talking about the whole gun issue, and this is one way that Seattle and King County have decided to deal with the terrible, tragic shootings in Newtown and all the way going back to Columbine. I mean, this is definitely their political...
Yeah, and this is one of the ways that you kind of ring, W-R-I-N-G, the guns out of the populace, or out of the milieu, out of the nation, without doing any sort of a confiscation, which nobody is talking about, and which, frankly, I don't think would go very well. I think you'd have a whole bunch of little mini Wacos all over again. Mark Taylor Canfield, thank you, Mark. We're talking about this 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So, slavery, guns, there's a lot going on today. We'll be back with more conversation of these things in just a minute. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Well, there were huge debates about what Congress could do with regard to the Commerce Clause. I mean, that was what the Kennedys used to desegregate the South, was the Commerce Clause. And you got your mic hot? Yeah. Okay. Well, why don't you pop
here
in? And...
There was a case in the late 90s, Lopez v. United States. The Congress tried to regulate guns in schools and using the Commerce Clause, and the Supreme Court struck it down, saying that was beyond the purview of the Commerce Clause to do that. So there would be a question as to whether or not you could...
But see, that was trying to regulate guns in schools. That is not an economic transaction. But what Corky was talking about, and what I've been talking about, which is when you buy a gun, you pay a registration fee. When you sell a gun, you pay a registration fee. And you have to have the gun insured. Those are all economic transactions.
True, but if they occur within a state, that's the question. It's not an interstate commercial transaction. So if I'm...
Oh, but if you want to interpret the Commerce Clause the way the Kennedys did, and, I mean, they basically said that they could regulate not just a Woolworths, but a locally owned lunch counter in the state of
Absolutely.
Georgia, because that locally owned lunch counter served Heinz 57 ketchup.
Right.
And so you could say that gun was made outside that state.
I would say you'd had a much different Supreme Court back then than we do now. So, because it would be before them. That's what they would probably look to Lopez and say, wow, you have to be a little careful in terms of how far you stretch that Commerce Clause.
Yeah. Very interesting.
That's my thoughts. You never know what they're going to do.
Yeah, of course. And of course, I don't think they should do it at all. Thank you, Shano. Charles in Atlanta. Hey, Charles, you had some thoughts on Dr. Rodriguez.
Yeah, that was an interesting conversation. I just want to comment that toward the end, he said that... the slaves were, the British had lost, and so there was a big discussion of what do they do with the people.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, they relocated, people got, up to Nova Scotia.
Right.
And today, if you go up to Nova Scotia, there's a black community there that is comes from the American Revolution. And, the African-American AME Church has always been significant in, you know, American history as far as slavery and things like that. And I'm AME. And my parents went up there several years ago to a church, and they, you know, it's pretty much, they're a prosperous community up there. You know,
mm-hmm.
Actually, they're probably more prosperous than a typical people because they have, you know, very indigenous.
Mm-hmm.
But also one thing he said that how slaves were, you know, there was very few slave uprisings.
Mm-hmm.
From what I heard, there were at the very beginning slavery. Slaves were very rebellious, and the slave owners would put those down very swiftly and violently. And matter of fact, they were so suspicious. I mean, you've seen pictures of different, you know, irons they put around slaves' necks.
Yes, I've seen those.
Like,
yeah.
Yes, because, you know, they were, slave owners were very, very wary of slaves all the time. And so, you know, maybe that's, you know, why there weren't that many slave rebellions.
It was a brutal system. It was a police state, and it was enforced by brutality, and slaves were considered property, and they could easily be not just killed,
exactly.
Which was the ultimate punishment, but they could be, you know, life could be worse than hell. They could have fingers cut off. They could have arms cut off. They could be maimed. They could be whipped. They could be, you know, when you consider the history of slavery,
right,
in the United States, well, not just in the United States, all around the world. And it's still going on, by the way. Ellen Ratner's involved in helping free slaves in Sudan, where the Arabs from the north are taking the Dinka, the dark-skinned people from the south, slavery, as slaves, and into the north, use them as slaves, and then when they get old, they dispose of them. I was physically there in South Sudan, about 15 miles from Darfur, when we were in the community of Gok Machar, a little town of about 7,000 people near the border. And a group of freed slaves have been brought south by this group that Ellen works with, Christian Solidarity International. And there was an old man in that group, and we were, it was Ellen and me and a couple of other people, and Joe Madison and his wife Sherry and my son Justin and a bunch of the people from the village. And this older guy, this older freed slave, who was just, you know, an old broken man. He was describing who he was before he was taken slave, and he was describing his brother and his brother's daughter. And the woman who was the mayor of the village of Gok Machar suddenly bursts into tears and runs over screaming and grabs him and says, "That was me. You're describing." He was her niece. He was her uncle. She was his niece. And it was an amazing thing. So I can tell you, slavery is still going on around the world.
Yes, it is. Thank you.
And a terrible thing it is. Thank you, Charles. Thanks for adding to our knowledge base. Monroeville is the capital city of James Monroe. This is one of the great theories that the founders had, was they could solve the slavery problem by shipping Africans back to Africa. And President James Monroe actually did it. He helped create a country in West Africa. It's is it Monrovia? Monroeville. It's named after James Monroe. And in fact, Charles, what's his name, was the president of it recently. They speak English there. And it's actually American slaves who were repatriated back to Africa. And I'm sorry, it's not at the tip of my tongue. Usually things are. But anyway, Marty in Evergreen Park, Illinois. Hey, Marty, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to share a story that I heard on the radio a couple weeks ago. I was listening to NPR, and they were interviewing this guy that was at a convention in Las Vegas, this gun manufacturers convention, and not the NRA, but like another trade group. But anyway, so this guy was basically talking about how if we ban military assault rifles from private citizens, how it would just destroy their industry, how they wouldn't, how they'd have to go back. And, you know, he just really was kind of going into a lot on how devastating it would be for the, for that industry. So I did a little research on DuckDuckGo and found out that a lot of these gun manufacturers make very little money, if any, if they even break even, selling military assault weapons to the actual military. What they do is they use the military, particularly as an advertisement, to sell their guns to the private citizens.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, it makes a certain amount of sense, Marty. I can't back it up, but it makes a certain amount of sense. It's Liberia is the country, our liberty, and Monrovia. Excuse me, as the capital city was James, and named after James Monroe, our little experiment. Very strange stuff. Anyhow, coming up tomorrow, we'll be talking with the chairman of the Senate Health Committee, Senator Tom Harkin, about the state of health care in America. We're going to be doing our show live from the Radio Row at Families USA Health Action 2013. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, You're It. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.